Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
Welcome back to listeners. How are you? Happy July to you all. Doc, you know, I'm especially excited about July because why?
Because it's your birthday month.
My birthday month. So shout out to all the Cancers and the Leos out there. Leo, stand up.
Okay.
My birthday's not until the end of the month, of course. But also, Missy's birthday is in July.
Yeah, it's July 26th.
Yeah, so we're going to be turning up all month long. But hey, Doc, let's hop right into it because we have a very special guest in the studio. I think this is his first time here. And
he's
making national and international headlines. And
lies.
So we're happy. You know, it's taken 6 long years.
Don't try to put that on me,
listeners.
That's on y'all.
But we are happy to have you. Y'all probably recognize that voice, y'all. It's Dr. Ricky Jones, the chair of PAS, Pan African Studies at University of Louisville. So welcome, Dr. Jones, to the show.
Yeah.
So we are so
family.
Glad, man. Yes, you took a raid out to get here because you've been jet setting, but you have been making headlines, especially this week, Dr. Jones, because of your most recent column for the Courier Journal, which I think also was kind of
USA Today,
exactly. Yeah. But this one, what was the title of it?
It was James Baldwin right when he called white Americans moral monsters?
All right. So you wrote this column, and you write columns frequently for the Courier Journal, for the Louisville Leo Weekly, for various outlets, and you always interrogate issues of race and social justice. That's not anything new for you, right? You've done that. You do that on your own podcast and radio show. But this particular piece caught a lot of attention, especially at Fox News, right? So you were just on Fox News this week. But just give us a little bit of context. Who was James Baldwin? For listeners who don't know, we talked about him before, but who was he and why was this particular piece something that resonated with you to want to talk about in your piece?
Yeah, legendary black writer James Baldwin, native New Yorker, wrote Notes on a Native Son, Fire Next Time, all these things. But what generated this was a Baldwin quote that is in the piece. And Jay, if you could pull that his quote up.
Absolutely.
From the beginning of that piece.
Yeah.
Baldwin in 1979 very quickly started a manuscript that explored his friendships with Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and my Morehouse brother Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
And he never finished the manuscript, but Raoul Peck took it and made it the foundation for his film I'm Not Your Negro.
And Doc, you and I hosted some screenings of that at the speed.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah.
We did that.
So it was a really well received documentary. And I mean, white people
for some
ate it
people.
Up. Yeah, for some. Okay, okay, yeah.
Yeah. For some people. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but in the documentary, and these are what Baldwin wrote. Another of my Morehouse brothers, Samuel Jackson, who narrated the film, goes through Baldwin's evaluation. Kyla, did you pull that quote from Baldwin up? Read that.
Let's hear it from Baldwin himself.
Let's hear it from Baldwin.
He's doing an interview, and so James Baldwin has provided his own reflections about. So let's take a listen, listeners.
I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long. They really don't think I'm human. I have basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters.
That's the original quote from James Baldwin.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love the way, I love his cadence. I love, anytime James Baldwin spoke, I just love it. I mean, it's riveting, it gives you chills. And, you know, it's absolutely correct, right? He's talking about a specific time in America. And the thing that I loved about your op-ed piece, Ricky, was that you were revisiting this piece because you were saying that not only is it indicative of our past, but also what we're experiencing contemporaneously under 45.
Yeah. So that was my question. You know, this was Baldwin's quote. It's included in I'm Not Your Negro. And I just asked the question, was he right? And some of our white brothers and sisters went crazy.
They were happy. The point I love that you make is that people love, especially these, these neoliberals, they love to say that what we're experiencing now is something new, right? That somehow because of 45 or maybe because of George Bush or whatever kind of contemporary white figure you want to pick, that these figures somehow brought out the worst in white people.
Mm-hmm.
And as you point out, Dr. Jones, Baldwin did not experience 45. Or the Bushes as presidents, right? But that somehow the issues that he spoke to those many years ago, and he's been dead since we were 7, Doc, right? So somehow the things that he lived through before our time are the same or similar issues that we're facing today. So talk to us a bit about that, Dr. Jones, about how that argument is baseless, that somehow it's 45 that's making people act ugly, the white rage is all inspired by immigration, that somehow what's happening in the 2000s is what's making white people act crazy when you say it's been happening for a long time.
Well, that was the whole point. I mean, what people attempt to do is lift all of these issues up out of history. Mm. You know, when you talk about the latest rage where people, this what I really see is false moral outrage of immigrant children being taken from their parents. I'm like, you've already done that.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
did that to black children, you know, very early on in this country's genesis. When people, you know, have this outrage about voter suppression, which there is no voter fraud. I mean, the majority of folk in this country who are eligible to vote don't go out to do it. There is no voter fraud. But voter suppression is real.
Mm-hmm.
But it always has been.
Yeah.
When the country was founded, only property-holding white males could vote.
What's extremely startling about people's reaction to the things that we are witnessing right now, right? The immigration, ripping apart of families, voter suppression. It really shows how many Americans have no idea of the founding and the history of the country that they live in. And it's these people who make those kind of false equivalencies. Like we both watched you on Fox News, and he's like, well, what if I would have said that black people were morally corrupt? And wouldn't that be itself racist? Which I never would, right? Right, so like this kind of false equivalence argument. Like one, you're quoting Baldwin. So that was his first mistake, right? Because he's making it seem as if this is your assertion. When you're revisiting Baldwin, and it was Baldwin's assertion, and you're revisiting it because we're living in a particular time in which seemingly white liberal folk and other white folk across the country, you know, who, you know, are claiming they're not racist, are shocked and floored by what's currently going on under 45. And for many black Americans who know the history of this country, this isn't a shock. Yeah. This is, you know, something that has happened in the past, something that has continued to happen, and something that is happening now. So as you mentioned, the whole idea of ripping apart families that happened with enslaved black people, right, during enslavement. You mentioned in your op-ed piece Reconstruction, voter suppression,
Jim Crow laws.
Native American genocide, Japanese American internment.
Yeah, you mentioned all of these really startling, inhumane atrocities that are a part of American history. And yet and still, people want to act as if, oh my God, like what's going on right now? And we're better than this, and this is in our country. And it's like, actually it is.
But simultaneously, there's also this notion, which I love that you highlight, that the majority of white people are either silent about it or are complicit in it, right? There's this whole notion of, oh, that's a loud minority, right? That most people are not like 45, and my people never own, you know, and it's like the reality is all of y'all was not, you know, freedom fighters were somehow involved as white people, and your ancestors were not involved in black liberation, right? So what do you make, Dr. Jones, and you too, Doc, about white folks who are either complicit or who are silent, right? And what should be their call to action? Because I took Baldwin's documentary really as a call to action to white people. Like, yo, this, you know, like, this ain't nothing new to black people, right? What do you all see as the charge from Baldwin, from you, Dr. Jones, from you, Dr. Story, you know, in terms of you all as academics? What is the charge to white people, right, who claim that this is not part of me or what I represent? What do they need to do differently?
I'm not charging them with anything.
Okay, all right.
I mean, and I have to be very clear about that. I think a number of us are crossing a line, and you're seeing it more and more with folk like Ta-Nehisi Coates and his approach to this, and Michael Harriet over at The Root. Friends of mine, the expectation for the majority of white people is so incredibly low.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there are no expectations to be humane, to be just, to really fight for equality. I mean, and that's the question with folk who say, well, I don't think like that, yet they say very little and do even less,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, I mean, some of the notes, because you brought up the Tucker Carlson interview, and it's amazing how many people are coming to me like, oh, you know, I applaud you for being calm and this, that, and the other. First of all, I got to tell people, it ain't my first rodeo.
Yeah.
Two, I went to Morehouse College, man. You know, somebody else sent me a Martin Luther King Jr. quote, judging people by the content of their character because you're clearly a racist. I was like, yeah, I know about that dude. We went to the same school.
Oh,
you know? So I went to Morehouse College. And I'm a noob. I'm
gonna say third about you're Kappa, which
so,
probably should
so
be number,
always
should
cool.
be number one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
you're
I'm always
cool,
cool,
cool and smooth. Yes.
Yeah, but you know, beyond that, it was a 5-minute interview.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in this country for 5 decades, and I'll be 51 July 13th. So my birthday is this month.
Uh-oh.
As well.
Stand up,
right?
Cancer.
So yep. So I've lived in this country for 5 decades as a black man. If I can't be cool for 5 minutes. In an interview where a person is showing incredible racial insensitivity,
yeah.
an unwillingness to listen, and out and you know outright personal disrespect,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's what our people have grown accustomed to. I knew what that space was when I walked into it, but it's important that it be exposed. It's not 1975 anymore, right?
Yeah.
So Fox News stuff doesn't stay on Fox News. It goes throughout the world, and
certainly.
You see exactly how these people are behaving. You know, so you got people, the emails that are being sent, and you know they're coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, N-word this, N-word that. You know, monkey, silverback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's your appreciation for the white people that fought to free you? And,
oh,
you know, all of this
oh,
stuff.
God.
Calls to the university president. But come on, we've worked together for years, Kyler.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used to that.
Yeah.
I've been going through that forever.
Certainly, yeah.
Gonna
mm-hmm.
continue to go through it. And so the first response for a lot of these folks, who are dyed-in-the-wool racist in and of themselves. And I'm not talking about all white people. That was never the point, and that wasn't Baldwin's point either. He was
mm-hmm.
talking about a good percentage of people.
Yeah.
The first line of defense for them, which is empty, is if you place issues of racial animus, racism, the violence, the nastiness that comes with all of that on the table, they'll turn and say, you're a racist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get called a racist by
yeah.
folk like that every 10 minutes. And so you know where it's coming from. And lastly, I'll say this about the Tucker Carlsons of the world, the people who send the emails. I mean, I've had people send notes attacking my daughter.
Oh, my God.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's happened in the past. I mean, my daughter's 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not a moral monster, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Calling the president, the new president of the university, you know, of course, well, how can you let this Negro work there? And like Baldwin,
wow.
I'm not your Negro.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. But the funny thing with a lot of white brothers and sisters, I'm not sure if they know how vile some of the stuff they say and do really is.
Mm.
But when you bring that to their attention and you say, hey, look, this is not just offensive, but it's damaging. To you, to me, to people collectively, to the country as a whole, and yay, even the world. And then they still respond with such incredible, not just disregard,
yeah.
but indignity and aggression. That becomes another conversation about how they're ethically grounded.
Yeah, I mean, that almost proves the point. I mean,
it really does.
You know, that just proves the point to me that if someone, yeah, I don't know.
It does. I mean, but I think that the cognitive dissonance that they exhibit when they are called out on the carpet around white supremacist behavior, ideals, morale, if you will, and the antagonism and the aggression that ensues is wrapped around the cognitive dissonance of the myth of race and the myth of white supremacy. And so it allows them to not see that, if this happened to my family, if my family were separated or ripped from one another, if people who all were the same skin tone as me wanted to go and cast a ballot and were suppressed, you know, with all of this arbitrary, you know, jargon and rhetoric, if my whole race of people were intimidated ritualistically by the state, by police, by government agencies, etc., right, it would be very clear to them. But the cognitive dissonance that comes into play when it comes to being socialized white supremacist, being socialized racist, allows them to somehow see it as different, as distinct. And so for me, I feel like most folks, right, are plainly aware of the injustices and atrocities that are happening to the majority of black and brown folk in our country. They just choose not to care. And that's why I think that it was so important and so awesome, you know, for lack of a better word, that you revisited Baldwin and revisited that specific quote that he asserts, right? Because it does call on a sense of morality,
yeah.
right? I mean, as we know, most of the candidates, most of the folks who are talking about, who are trying to, overturn Roe v. Wade, who are trying to undo civil rights legislation when it comes to voting and that kind of access, who are trying to come back with school choice and make schools segregated again, they're always up on some moral high horse around American values, family values, et cetera, right? And so the fact that, Baldwin is like, y'all's moral character is a question based on the historical record, based on fact, not based on stuff that was invented or made up. You can look at any history book. Well, maybe not the recent ones coming out of Texas, but I mean, certainly ones that were accurate in their portrayal of American history. And, and so, yes, to me, it's a question, not so much of just behavior, right? But it's a question of morality. If you believe in a divine at all, your soul cannot sit with what is going on to black and brown people in this country. It cannot. And if it does sit and if it does rest, then yes, someone needs to call you out on your moral. And so glad that Baldwin did. It's unfortunate that Baldwin's words almost 40-something years later are still relevant. That's what's, to me, unfortunate. The fact that Baldwin's quote that you use is still very telling about the climate that we're in.
Well,
And
Baldwin says, in effect, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do.
Yeah.
Right. And so then the question becomes for all of us, if the answer to Baldwin's query is still in the affirmative, then what do we do?
Mm-hmm. And that's my question, too, because X talks about appealing to the moral, to a moral, like these people are morally bankrupt. Let me rephrase that. If you take the people are morally bankrupt, right, it doesn't do any good to try to appeal to the morality, right? So then what do we do? Is it, did it come about laws? Did it become about voting? Does it become about... Yeah, so what is the answer? If people are moral monsters, then what is the solution?
But I don't have the answers to all that.
Okay.
And I don't pretend to have the answers to all that. These are questions that I'm still wrestling with.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like any scholar, like any writer, like any human being, I'm still wrestling with all those questions. So I'm not coming into any space, as Paulo Freire said, trapped in a circle of certainty.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I'm
not saying that I have all the answers, because again, when you think you know everything, then you can learn nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the only thing for me at this point, right, as we move through, this time, is if that answer is in the affirmative, then we know what we need not expect. Not expect there to be any type of decent engagement, any type of humane intent, any type of moral grounding from a good percentage of the people who are functioning in that space. Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't mean that it's all white people.
Of course,
and that's what people like Tucker Carlson, of course, want to bastardize the argument and move away from it. But even if our white brothers and sisters in arms understand that it is not, they cannot depend on the majority of their own people to try to make the world a more just, decent, and humane place, then maybe they'll step their game up. But I do not know that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've witnessed my own students, some of my white students who've come into my classroom who don't have a thorough, kind of racial consciousness established, who have no sense of American history or the contemporary struggles that we're going through now, who have tried to challenge family members, uncles, aunts, grandparents, parents, and those family members have kind of scoffed at them, and admonished them and banished them, if you will, right? So cutting off financial support for their education, saying all sorts of awful things to them, and they've been trying. They've been trying to, what they feel, is be good white allies, right? Challenge the racism where you're at. Challenge it in your home environment. Challenge it with those who are closest to you, and maybe that will affect some change. And they've seen parents, elders, guardians, folks who have raised them and who supposedly, right? Now you supposedly intentionally, but supposedly love them, completely disinvite them to Thanksgivings and dinners because they're going to create a problem. They don't know why you're acting this way. We're not sure.
Like you got dropped the mania, right?
Basically.
You're a slave, you want to run away, something wrong with you.
Yeah, basically, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you being so aggressive? Why are you ruining family holidays, right? And this is their own kin.
Right.
So I certainly don't have an expectation for them to do something for me or my community or my people in the same way in which this is the example I'm consistently seeing in all the years I've been teaching. When white students come in my classroom, they become really fierce allies. They try to go and challenge those who claim to love them, and they're completely, disowned, if you will, and thrown out and and cast out. So I'm like, yo, if you're doing this to your family members just because they want to challenge you not to use the N-word at Thanksgiving, yeah. Whoa, I don't really have. And like you said, the bar isn't that high.
Which, again, is not this, new.
Yeah, and that's not new at all.
Because they become the only worse thing than a Negro. They become a Negro lover in their family's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that in and of itself is a taint.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I think it's one thing that we can do, Jay, and y'all been doing it, right? And I try to do it with my co-host 12, Mr. FTC, on our show with iHeartMedia. And I try to do it. We got to keep doors open to try to create spaces where we can have these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
We got to keep doors open where we can walk through and not just talk about it, but be about it and fight for certain things, mm-hmm. you know? And we got to do that with a certain degree of integrity and not stay locked into small little silos.
Okay.
So me, as a professor, right, we're only going to teach so many students in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Only one, just because of the numbers of the classes that are set. But two, because there are a whole lot of people who do not have the financial wherewithal, and that is becoming increasingly problematic mm-hmm. to even get to a college or university these days. So you're only going to teach so many people. So then write a book,
mm-hmm.
right? But, I mean, we live in an anti-intellectual country at this point. There's a lot of people
yes.
ain't going to read a book. If anybody thinks that Tucker Carlson or his viewers even knew who the hell James Baldwin was.
I know. That's what I was
at the
like,
outset of that
interview.
We're
talking about the car all the way over here.
Yeah.
Like, I love that you kept saying, yo, first of all, read the piece.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Before we even discuss this,
yeah.
your viewers need to go read the piece.
Because I was
like,
keep...
you said read the piece five times. I don't, you know, and I'm
yeah,
like,
because clearly you didn't read it.
I mean, yeah, and you probably don't read, and it's no shade, but again,
there was shade.
I mean, it's definite shade because we've done, in fact, when we talked about raising children in households with books, when we talked yeah. about that Jimmy Kimmel, Man on the Street interviews where he interviews Americans in the last year, what is the most recent book you read?
Oh, yeah, he says in your lifetime, he said name a book. He says name any book. You know, he says,
and
do you read books? Yeah, I read books. Name a book. And then they begin to say,
And they just did.
Well, actually, I don't read books. I read magazines. Or actually, you know, like,
Sarah Palin.
And braggadocious kind of way, like, I don't read books. You know,
yeah.
You know, and so,
yeah,
as
and
you
people,
always talk.
And people do that. I mean, a lot of Americans, they brag on the fact that they don't read.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
brag on the fact that they haven't read a book in the past year. They haven't read a book in their lifetime. I don't have books in my house. I mean, and so, yeah, when you're talking about people not having an awareness of what's going on currently, they're not reading
or
a newspaper.
Yeah.
Or historically, yeah. they have no idea.
But my thing is what we can do.
Yeah.
You know, so we're teaching kids in the classroom. Only can do so many.
Mm-hmm.
Write a book. Only so many people going to read them. If they ain't going to read a 200-300-page book, drop that down, write a newspaper column.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
750, 850 words.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
For people who ain't going to read it all,
yeah.
do a radio show. Do a
yeah.
podcast.
Yeah,
maybe
absolutely.
They'll listen.
Yeah.
People who ain't going to sit down and have the patience to listen for 30 minutes or an hour, do a quick spot on television. It's only going to last. That's an ADD medium. It's only going to last for 3 to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hit people wherever you can to prick them.
Certainly.
You know, because folk are like, well, why you go on Fox? I'm like, look, first of all, man, I'm like Ali, God. I mean, I feel like I'm the heavyweight champion, bro.
I
take all comers anytime, anywhere until they cut me off like
okay.
they did, you know, on Fox. Like, we ain't going to tell this Negro good night, which was rude. That was uncivil.
Okay.
That was monstrous. But you got to go into all of these spaces and
yes.
be brave about it. And the last thing I say is about this, about our own people, about our privileged people. Now, Kyla, you know, less than 2% of the American population got PhDs.
Yeah.
Very small percentage, right around 4 or 5% of the American professorate is black. But there are far too many privileged black folk who are the best prepared to fight. They opt out, man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They run from it. They're all about their vulgar careerism. They're about their loot. They're about their shine.
Certainly.
They're about their small circle. And they don't care about engaging in anything,
yeah, yeah.
you know, that's going to be collective or put them at risk. So they're selfish and they're cowardly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so people are like, I just couldn't deal with people, you know, talking to me like that. First of all, ain't nobody saying jack to my face like that.
Okay.
They send a lot of the notes.
Yeah.
But man, at this point, if you can't deal with somebody calling you an N-word
yeah.
mm-hmm. in an email,
yeah.
then bruh,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I got a PhD, but I grew up in the housing projects of Atlanta, man.
Okay.
So that's you know what I'm saying?
I love when he reminds people of that. Like, yo, okay. Hey, don't let the smooth taste fool you. You know
that.
Hey, don't let the suit fool you.
6'2", 205, bro.
Listen, his head is to the back. Yo, his head is to the back today, y'all. He's dead serious.
6'2", 205. I went to Morehouse College, didn't want to go to Harvard, and still don't care nothing about it.
Okay.
Drop you like a sack of potatoes, you come in my face talking all that foolishness.
I know, that's right. I know.
And still
that's
be
right.
Cool about it.
I love it.
I know,
I love
that's
it.
Right.
I want to change gears right quick because we have you here. You're the chair of PAS, and Pan-African Studies is a very, of course, a very near dear to my heart because, you know, y'all have been the people who have helped mold me during my many, many years at U of L, despite not graduating. But, and of course, not here, you know, but I
take
love
your
my PAS people.
Back to school,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, eventually. You know, room for me, listeners. But I want, and so PAS is a really special department. Brag a little bit about Dr. Jones, about your department. We are 45 years old, I think, at this point.
45 years old.
Talk a bit about, there's a brand new PhD program. Talk a bit about what makes the PAS program at U of L special. Talk about your faculty and your staff. Talk about your students. What makes y'all so badass, like I know y'all to be?
Yeah, bro, we could talk about that for a whole show. Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville, one of the oldest black studies departments in the country. Founded in 1973. Got a history of straight-up warriors. You know, people like Bill Green, one of the first chairs, Tom Green, I'm sorry, of the department, Robert Douglas, who I call the warrior chair, Dr. J. Blaine Hudson, who was the first dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. You know, Kyla Story, me right now. Yes. You know, we got 10 faculty members right now. We've had more. We got other lines. But I always feel like, and I've been in PAS for 22 years.
Yes.
Okay. First PhD program in the South. We have been as strong as we have been. Because we have been committed to loving black people and the black human experience. And we've had professors who've been grounded in that. And so I'm the type of dude, man, I like to roll with a crew.
All right.
Yeah. And my crew ain't necessarily got to be big.
Yeah.
Because if I got 20 and they soft.
And they weak. Yeah,
they not committed.
Yeah.
You know, they ain't really down.
Yes.
I want 5 head knockers.
All right.
Who gonna rock.
Yes.
So we have had a history of head knocks, and every now and then we'll have some people who ain't like that.
Okay.
And they leave.
Yeah.
Because they are not black studies scholars.
Yeah, certainly.
So, you know, when you talk about Pan-African Studies, man, you talk about most of the black professionals and some of the white ones, quite frankly, because people ask that stupid question. Do white people take Pan-African Studies classes? Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Yes.
People like Tucker Carlson don't, but other white kids do
yes.
take Pan-African Studies classes. But when you talk about a ton of the young black professionals, 40 and under in this city,
they've come through.
At
yes.
some point,
we can name names. Yeah,
the department and I individually have laid my hands on them at some point. And so they're grounded in something different. Yeah. And so you can, I'll finish by saying this, man. As universities in this country, the University of Louisville has been subjected to this. As they become more businesses rather than educational institutions, mm-hmm. they're in a really interesting place.
Okay.
But let me tell you, in the most multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural America that we've ever seen, you cannot claim to be a serious university if you ain't got good black studies, if you ain't got good Native American studies, if you ain't got good Latin American studies,
absolutely.
If you ain't got good women's and gender studies,
yes.
if you ain't got good Asian descendant studies. If you ain't got all of that, then you can't be serious. And that's something that the University of Louisville and quite honestly, public higher education in the state of Kentucky needs to worry about with the direction of the current governor.
Yeah.
So it's Pan-African Studies, you're right. Pan-African Studies is badass.
No, are.
Always been badass.
Yes. Yes.
Gonna be badass
to be.
As long as I'm here.
Dr. Story, talk a little bit about you all's commitment, because you've been at the department for a long time. You all's commitment, what I appreciate most, one of the most things I appreciate about y'all was your commitment to bridging the gap between campus and community.
Hold
right?
on, before she say anything.
Okay.
You know how it is back in the day. You're in the club. You see a fine girl or fine dude.
Depending
on your orientation.
Yes. What you like?
You know what I'm saying?
What
you like,
move for,
I got to have her.
Yes.
When she came to interview, when Dr. Kyla Story came to interview, that's where I was. It was like love in the club.
Yeah.
I said, I got to have her.
But listen, Doc, I understand. I was in Dr. Story's first class, her first semester, and I was like, this person is brilliant. I'm U of L did something right. And, of course, I don't have to brag on her. Y'all know how
best
I feel about
classroom about teacher Doc. I've ever seen.
Yeah, brilliant. Yes. I hate to say it, but better than you. And just you second
oh
best.
God.
I can say it because I'm about his colleague. So
did you take a class
it.
From me?
I haven't, Dr. Zomba.
Did you take a class from me?
No, but yes. I can say this. But,
did you take a class
but
from me?
One time,
no.
Doc, Kyla.
Well, he can't say
Kyla,
that.
Kyla's classroom was next to yours. So I was sitting outside your room and listen. Yeah. And I, yeah, so I'm teasing. Yeah.
That's
I'm
probably sure. why he failed your class, because he was listening to my class.
I'm sure you're brilliant, but Dr. Story, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the commitment of your department to really, you know, because again, you, Dr. Jones, several of your professors, Dr. McCormick, are involved in community initiatives, right, are giving public lectures, are going to public spaces off of campus, are involved in leadership initiatives. Why is that important for you all to do? Because a lot of other disciplines, it's like you come to my classroom, come and hear my lecture, holler at you. Why do y'all have to get up? Why is it important for you all to get into the streets, to meet people where they are, and then not to just, and to recognize organic intellectuals, right, to recognize people who may not be formally educated, to encourage people like myself to come back to school and get degrees? Why do you all feel the need to go outside of the four walls of the campus?
Well, because, I mean, that is the founding of Black Studies as a discipline, of Pan-African Studies, Black Studies, African Diaspora Studies, whatever the nomenclature is and whatever university it's housed, the mission of Black Studies is community engagement and responsibility. That is the mission of it as a discipline. And so because it comes out of an ACT-UP activist history, because it was fought for, petitioned for, right? People had to advocate for Black Studies to be incorporated within a university system because, you know, quite frankly, there just wasn't representation when it came to Black people's contribution to world history, art, or culture. And so because Black Studies was a discipline in which people had to literally advocate and fight for, have sit-ins, write petitions, and do so on and so forth. One of the missions was community engagement and responsibility. And so we are literally not doing our job as Black Studies practitioners or professors if we are not publicly engaging Black people and Black communities. So it is part of the mission. It is part of who we are as professors. And I think personally, you know, like the professors you named, like me, Ricky, Dr. Brandon McCormick, you know, I feel like that is our also personal mission. We are interested. We didn't get into the professoriate or to become educators or intellectuals to sit up in the institution itself.
Yeah.
We, you know, are not who we feel we're beholden to, our Black communities, our Black people, and getting them free, right? Getting them free ideologically, intellectually, mentally, letting them know a sense of history, something that they can be proud of, something they can look back on with pride, and something they can continue to basically strive for, keep striving for the freedom that their ancestors fought for, that we're still committed to, get them to be committed to it. There's no point in writing books that people can't understand. There's no point in delivering a classroom lecture in which students are lost. There's no point in staying up in our offices and on campus to the few students that can afford to come to higher education and keeping that message and keeping that history and that culture inside those walls. So right. It's important to teach at any and every platform, you know, like Ricky mentioned, like going on television, writing books, teaching in classrooms, and also going to community, right, community things that are happening, right? So whether that means you're going and speaking at a church, whether that means you're going and speaking at some kind of forum that a community organization or a nonprofit is holding, whether or not you're marching with your students, right, in their demonstrations, letting them see you, letting them know that you have their back, letting them know that you are interested first and foremost in Black freedom and liberation is important, I think, to all of us, and it's certainly important to the history of Black Studies.
I love it. I love it. Listeners.
Academic excellence and social responsibility.
All right. You happen to know the motto.
Seriously, that's what it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, so if you Black Studies, and I'll let you get to your next thing.
Yes, sir.
They say you got to do three things. You got to do your research.
Okay.
You got to do your teaching. Mm-hmm. You got to do the service. And if you're going to be with us in Pan-African Studies for any period of time, not just visit us for 4 or 5 years, on our faculty,
this your home.
But be with us, you got to be a G. Yeah. You got to be a rider.
Yes.
If you ain't a rider, you can't roll with us.
Y'all are some riders. Listeners, we have been blessed to have Dr. Ricky Jones. Y'all got to check out his podcast. It's the Ricky Jones Show with 12, Mr. FTC. It is on, if you're here locally, it's on your FM dial at 93.1. iHeartRadio is on the iHeartRadio app. I was going to let you go, but I got to ask on behalf of
we're off till September, so I just can't hang with you.
Okay, the original Doc story. The original Doc story pointed out, and that you were on Mysteries at the Museum. Do you remember this?
Oh,
and
it's been a while. My dad.
Doc's dad.
I have to preface with my dad. And how you doing, Dad?
The original Doc story.
Yes,
what's up?
And I call him the original Doc story. Because when I was growing up as a little girl, I was like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "I'm a professor," and I'm like, "Okay." So he is the original Doc story. And my dad is a huge, huge fan of yours, Rick.
Oh, that's love, man.
He, anytime he sees you on anything, whether, and you know, and his favorite was he saw you on Mysteries of the Museum, which I don't even know that
show. She was like, what is that show?
You know, but yeah, my dad mentioned it to me this morning. He knew you were going to be here in the studio. He's just a fan. He feels like you have incredible range as an intellectual. He, I think, admires you. He certainly is grateful for all the love you've shown me over the years. So he just adores you. And so he mentioned Mysteries at the Museum, like,
and you know, and I'm a pop culture fanatic. So I'm like, yeah. Oh my goodness, like a for real cable TV show today, Fox News. So, but all that to ask you, Dr. Jones, what has been kind of your favorite? Like, talk a bit about the celebrity part of being who you are. Like, what have you really enjoyed? I mean, you've gone to the red carpet events, you've been on cable news, you travel, like, what have you really enjoyed? Your book tours, like, what's, like, the kind of fun part about being you? What have you really enjoyed? Is it, like...
You know the best part of being me goes back to what we were just talking about, and my daughter can attest to this, and we talk about our people. What happens in Louisville, you know, I'm out, whether it's at the grocery store, on the street, going to a restaurant, and it's happened with my daughter so often that she just ignores it.
Expects it now, yeah.
But black folk coming up to me and saying, Doc, you'll know me.
Yeah.
Thank you for everything that you do, man. I appreciate you fighting for us because a lot of us can't fight for ourselves. That's the best part of being me.
Amen.
You know, when outside of that, all the other stuff, it don't matter. So that's the best part of being me. And people give me good bourbon.
All right. We haven't reached that level. Yeah. Listeners, set the game up. You know, the people on people 93.1 get bourbon. We'll, no. But I appreciate that because we also, like, for me, again, I do something different than you all do. But again, when people come up to us and talk about our podcast, people we've never met, right, and say, right, what you are doing has saved my life, or what you have done has helped me have a conversation with my parent. Like, just the people who we don't necessarily know, right, who don't owe us anything, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm, who don't owe us no favors, come and let us know that they see us, right, that even we don't know they're watching us or listening to us, and that something that we've done has made life easier for them, better for them, or inspired them. And I'm sure you all get it tenfold, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, but look, let me say this about y'all. I think the work that you're doing here in this space is incredibly important. Not just about race, but gender, sexual orientation, all of these things. It's incredibly important. It's incredibly important that two and, you know, super intelligent people like you are doing something that really is benefiting others. And our people know that you ain't gonna leave them. They know that you're not gonna exploit them. They know that you're not here just for your personal aggrandizement, you know, and that you're gonna betray them. So I love the work that y'all are doing.
Thank you.
I love y'all. You know, I told Kyla if she liked dudes, I would marry her. And Jay, if I like dudes, I would marry you. You know what I'm saying?
That is a sweet, I accept.
I just love that.
That is the sweetest thing anybody's ever said to us.
And we love you so much, too.
We do. We're so glad that you spent this time with us. And please come back anytime, okay?
Anytime I'm invited. Because y'all the ones who didn't invite me here because you had too many impotent folks.
You
didn't want to spend time with an old bedraggled field Negro like myself.
We were saving the best for our sixth year. Well, Doc, what another wonderful show. I'm so glad that Dr. Jones is finally able to stop by and chill with us.
I know. And I guess I didn't realize that he hadn't been in before ever because he's been such a strong supporter
like
of the show.
We see him all the time and such.
Exactly,
yeah, so we didn't realize he
had
actually been in to the studio, but better late than never. So for real listeners, if you have not checked out Dr. Jones's podcast, please do that or read his writing. You know, again, I don't have to express how much I love and adore Dr. Jones and, you know, everybody over there at PAS. So anyway, Doc, we are out of time, but listeners, please stick around. We have some exciting interviews coming up later this month. I guess I can't say yet because stuff happens. Y'all know I can't hold water, child.
I know, and I can't stand it. You do that.
I don't know. They say patience is a virtue, child, but I do not have it. I don't have the patience. You know, I don't. You know, I'm always trying to spill the beans. You're always like making me stop, and
you
I was
always want to do
them,
that.
Give them details, but I don't know what that is. I don't have no patience.
I know. And if you haven't, listeners, yet. Please check out Pose.
Oh, yeah,
FX.
Of course. Yeah, we'll say that. Yeah, so y'all.
Check out Pose.
And we'll talk about that later. Okay, we'll talk about that later this month. But Pose on the FX channel is a great. We mentioned in the past months about it being the largest transgender cast of leading characters ever assembled. And of course, it's proven to be a brilliant show.
It's everything.
Yeah,
it's
so
everything.
It airs on Sunday nights, I believe at 9 p.m. on FX. You can, if you have the FX app, you can check it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But please, 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 please watch it, y'all. And we're going to talk about it soon. And hopefully we can book somebody. My goal is to book someone from Pose to come and talk to us in the coming weeks. So anyway, Doc, we are out of time. So please say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of LPM, its staff, or its underwriters.
Our executive producers are me, Jason Gardner.
And me, Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.